You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Tour de France, brought to you by iWoka, flexible loans built for small businesses. iWoka.co.uk. Today we're at L'Île de Ré.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with François Thomazeau.
Bonsoir.
And...
Here we go.
The Flying Blancmange.
Oh, this is getting worse now.
Lionel Burnley.
This is getting worse. I don't mind the flying pudding. But the flying Blancmange is just...
too accurate.
Blancmange is... No, Blancmange is weak. I mean, it would just break apart if it went quickly.
Yeah, meringue does not go down well either.
The flying Blancmange was... Yeah, I mean, we went for a bike ride today, Lionel. I was very impressed, actually. We're going well. And once you get it in that 62-tooth chain ring, there's no stopping it. It would take a very heavy object indeed. You were fairly churning that gear.
There's a compliment in there somewhere. I mean, it's very well hidden.
You were going well.
I'm just looking through our emails because...
It was a good day for Ireland today.
Nicola Bealey wrote in to say that perhaps the nickname ought to be the plummeting pudding.
I also got the suggestion of a nickname. Well, you've been calling me the half-wheeling haggis. I also, the clootie dumpling, somebody suggested. That's a good Scottish reference. I like it. Anyway, enough about that.
I guess Stefan Kuhn probably were attacked on the Pont de l'Île de Ré on the bridge, probably, you know, broke your Strava record. I don't know.
He attacked on both bridges today, didn't he? On the bridge on the start and the bridge at the finish. He obviously likes bridges.
Yeah, like me.
Unlike you, yeah. That could be your nickname, François. Stefan Kuhn. Apparently, I look like Stefan Kuhn, according to Andy McGrath, our colleague. He compared us.
Two Stefan Kuhns, I'd say. Anyway,
good day for Ireland.
Very good day for Ireland, Richard. Yeah, stage 10 of the Tour de France resuming after the rest day. And well, we had all that uncertainty overnight, didn't we? We knew that the COVID-19 test results would be shared with the teams, and we knew that the rule was if more than two members of any one team's 30-strong entourage of riders and staff had tested positive for COVID-19, they would be asked to leave the race. And all sorts of things were swirling around. We first of all heard that everyone was in the clear, and then we heard that there was an issue with De Koenig Quickstep and that there'd been possibly two positives there, but it turned out to be one positive which was retested and then came back negative. But four staff members for four different teams have tested positive for COVID-19 and have left the race. They are obviously anonymous. We don't know who they are health reasons, really. It's anonymous data, isn't it, that?
Reasons of medical confidentiality,
absolutely,
I guess.
Yeah. But one from Ineos Grenadiers, one from Mitchelton Scott, one from Cofidis, and one from AG2R La Mondiale. And then the big news was that the Tour de France boss, the director, Christian Prudhomme, had tested positive as well. And we've learned all about how Prudhomme has been in a bubble of his own, really, away from the riders and race bubble. Because, of course, his job is to go round the Tour de France...
Glad-handing.
Well, you know, yeah, meeting the people who are paying for and hosting the race. Well, we'll wait and see how that all pans out. But Christian Prudhomme has left the race. Mm-hmm. Is that right, François?
Yeah, I talked to the head of communication of ASO and the Tour de France, Philippe Sudre, who's very close to Christian Prudhomme, in terms professionally, and is also a good friend of him. And he told me that actually Christian Prudhomme had called him at 6 in the morning to say the man who's talking to you is positive. So that's the way...
Really extraordinary, isn't it? There were 800 or so tests, and very few, I think fewer positives than we probably expected. Yes. Given some other sports that have also implemented very kind of rigorous testing programs, seem to have been more positives, but for one of those tests to be the boss of the tour, it just seems extraordinary.
Yeah, as you say, he's probably the most exposed of them all, because he has to, you know, cheer the local mayor and local authorities. Even if it's been reduced a lot, but he's still, he's still having buffet and drinks and stuff, and ceremonies with the local people. So in the end, you're bound to be, the more people, of course, you talk to, and you, I suppose, they don't shake hands or anything, but still, know, they. So it was probably the most exposed. He said it had been tested three times before in the previous month. Well, maybe we can listen to Philippe Sudo, because he, you know, I called him and he told me what all about it. And so here is what he told me.
Well, Christa insisted to be tested, and it's been positive. So he's leaving the race for the next 7 days, and François Le Marchand will replace him in the car number one. He's used to François Le Marchand because he does the same thing on the Pyrenees, so he knows exactly the job, and there is no problem. This is something we have imagined before the Tour de France. We thought about the protocol. We knew that it was useless to put everyone in the race bubble, and that we should have some people like Christian, who meets a lot of people in the Tour de France. It was not possible for him to be in the race bible, because he sees all the people of the cities and the partners of the tour and sponsors and the journalists and so on. So he was not in that bubble. So we've made that modification in the race, and well, as you can see, between Ile d'Oléron and Ile de Ré, everything's going well.
There's been some concern that the other persons who have been in Christian's car might be positive. I mean, the Prime Minister was there only days ago. Do you think it's possible? Or?
Well, we don't know. I mean, we obviously send the information to all the people who've been in Christian's car, and now they will probably be tested and find out if they have it or not. That's all I can say. For mm-hmm. the moment, I don't know if the Prime Minister or other people have been infected by Christian.
What's the procedure now for the four team staff members who have been tested positive? They should. They have a second test?
Well, maybe they will have a second test, but they've left the race. And the contact people who were with them have been also be obliged to leave the race. Yes. So they're not with us anymore.
So Christian is supposed to be back, well, I suppose he have another test, but he's supposed to be back on the tour in the last week of the race?
So normally he should be back after 7 days. That makes the stage of Villard de Lans. He will be back with us at this time.
Well, it was Philippe Sudre, the head of communications at ASO. As Lionel said, I guess every mayor between Nice and La Rochelle will be going for COVID tests.
Well, one man who is going for COVID tests is the French Prime Minister, Jean Castex, because he was in Christian Prudhomme's car only two or three days ago, I think. And as you know, these days with the social networks, you know, lots of tweets saying he should resign. You know, the Prime Minister is, you know, well, you had a Prime Minister who tested positive for COVID yourself, but
maybe Prudhomme caught it from the Prime Minister.
And so, actually, the Prime Minister, it was forced by, I guess, Twitter pressure to send a tweet saying he would be tested and follow the same rules as everybody else. And so, you know,
he might have to isolate as well, having been in contact with somebody who's positive.
We'll see. But obviously, you know, Prudhomme's car is now can now be considered a cluster, because it's been, you know, going around France in a very, very tight space, you know, with various local authorities and VIPs. And we'll see. Maybe more news later.
And so François Le Marchand, a former rider, former teammate of Greg LeMond's, I think, in Zed Peugeot, is now the stand-in boss of the Tour to see it through to Paris. But on to the racing, stage 10.
Well, not only to see it through for a week, because Prudhomme will be back in a week, as Sudra said there, if a subsequent test is negative.
Well, let's hope that's the case. On to the racing, then, stage 10. A great day for the Irish, for Sam Bennett. It was a day where, you know, the road furniture was as threatening to the riders as the potential wind. The wind didn't really get up, but it did enough to kind of make everybody nervous. But we had a sprint finish. Before that, we had two riders off the front from very early on, Stefan Kung of Groupama FDJ and Michael Scher of CCC. But they were never allowed more than a couple of minutes, probably because the peloton would be in no mood to have to chase down something hard and fast in the second half of the stage. The intermediate sprint came quite close to the finish today. Matteo Trentin of CCC is making a good habit of winning the intermediate sprint, and they're not really following it up in the finish. Obviously, Kung and Scher were caught, and then, as you say, Kung had another go over the spectacular bridge to Ile de Ré. In the finish, another good lead out by Sunweb, but Case Ball was only eighth. And then, well, all eyes were on Sam Bennett and De Koenig Quickstep, and Michael Moorcock gave a fantastic lead out. Bennett came off the wheel and held off the challenge from Caleb Ewan this time. He failed to do it in the first week, didn't he? But this time Bennett got over the line to complete the set of Grand Tour stage wins. Not even Sean Kelly or Stephen Roach did that, but Bennett has won in the Giro, the Vuelta, and now the Tour de France. To be fair, Shea Elliott did do that back in the 1960s. Ewan second, Peter Sagan's third, Elia Viviani fourth, the world champion Mads Pedersen in fifth. So Bennett is now in the green jersey, 21 points ahead of Sagan, who has a reasonable gap to Brian Cockart and Matteo Trentin. There were some crashes as well. The most notable was the one that brought down Davide Formolo of UAE Team Emirates, and he has fractured his clavicle and is finished the race, but is apparently not going to start tomorrow. And we've also lost one of our audio diarists, Sam Bewley of Mitchelton Scott, who crashed and wasn't able to finish the stage. He's fractured his wrist. Domenico Pozzovivo of NTT didn't start the stage, but we knew that back on Sunday. So there we are. No change overall. Primoz Roglic still in the yellow jersey, and another stage for the sprinters probably tomorrow, and a chance for Sam Bennett to win in Poitiers, where Sean Kelly won his first Tour de France stage in 1978.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns, and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a small business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to our title sponsor, iWalker. And if you run a small business and you want to know what iWalker can do to help you, they offer loans and coronavirus business interruption loan scheme loans as well. Go to iwoca.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk. Have they been in touch with you yet, Francois, after your
not yet. I'm very surprised and disappointed, because I could do with a little bit of money. To upgrade the terrible dinners we have on this tour now.
That's not really how it works. That's not really how it works. That's not gonna fly, I'm afraid. Never mind flying puddings, that's not gonna fly. Shall we hear from one of our audio diarists? I mean, you mentioned that Sam Bewley crashed out today and was clearly in a lot of pain. It was one of the earlier crashes, again quite an innocuous one, you know, and nothing that he did wrong. It seemed to happen in the middle of the bunch. A few riders ended up in a field, and Sam Bewley unfortunately looked the worst hurt of them all, and he broke his wrist and was out of the race. His first Tour de France, quite late to make his debut in the race, and as we know from the diary entries he's been sending in, he was enjoying it, and we were thoroughly enjoying his diary. So we're very sad to see him go, and we hope he will send in something, maybe not tonight, but at some point, just to reflect on his first tour. An unfortunate end, though. But we did hear from another of our diarists tonight, Jens Kukeler, Belgian rider on EF Pro Cycling. It was almost a sort of Belgian style race today in a way. So let's hear what he had to say about the last sort of 24 hours and the COVID tests. He actually had COVID himself early on in this coronavirus period, if we can call it that. He had it and got over it, and he's riding the Tour de France. So let's hear what he had to say after today's stage.
So today we had stage 10, the first stage after the first rest day, and I have to say it felt like a stage in the Big Bang Tour. It was super hectic from start to finish. Everybody was really nervous, not only about the win, but also just the parcours today. I think everybody knew that it was going to be hectic with a lot of road furniture, small roads, villages we had to go through. And I'm not sure if it's a good thing that when everybody knows that it's going to be a dangerous parcours, because it just makes everybody more nervous. And you could feel it today in the bunch from start to finish. It was just nervous and hectic. But actually, it looked a little bit like stage one. Like halfway the stage, I went back to get some bottles. And you saw so many guys that had scratches everywhere, and the jerseys were cut. So I think a lot of guys came down. I think for us, it was all by all a good day. We managed to keep Rigo in the front. He didn't lose any time, so that was good. I think as most people, I was still a little bit nervous about the results from the COVID testing. But one thing that made it a little bit easier was the fact that a lot of our staff already got tested on Sunday morning and the results were all negative. So that kind of gave a good feeling that ours were going to be good as well. But I was happy when we heard that everybody was negative.
I quite enjoyed Cucullaire's description of the race today as being like a stage of the Bink Bank Tour with all the roundabouts and the curbs and the traffic calming measures. I mean, I must admit, Ile de Ré looked absolutely stunning from the aerial shots on TV. But from our bike ride onto the island yesterday, Richard, I did think it was slightly spoiled by all of the traffic, and the roads are set up for to try and manage cars, and there's cycle lanes, and the cycle lanes come in and the curbs, you know, narrow the road down to slow the traffic down, and that does make it really tricky for a bike race, which is going to be a flat
sprint
finish.
It's almost like a little mini motor racing circuit in a way. It's very fiddly, and yeah, I felt that yesterday, that it was going to be quite technical.
Roundabout stats, guys.
Yeah. Here we go.
So normally, I mean, it's very difficult apparently to figure out, but there would be 32,000 roundabouts in France, and there's 2/3 of the total roundabouts in the world. So, I mean, you remember a few years back, I mentioned that, you know, a town with lots of roundabouts usually indicates corruption from the local authorities, because it's very easy to, you know, to bury a little bit of money in the roundabout. I mean, you have a, you know, you say, well, this roundabout is going to cost 10,000 euros, when it actually costs 5, and the rest of the money goes.
Is that the going rate for a roundabout?
it's much more expensive than that.
I bet it is.
Yeah,
but any French lawyers listening, Francois would like to distance himself from the word
no,
corruption.
No, but I mean,
there.
Unfortunately, it's quite well known that, you know, sometimes, you know, this kind of constructions is a way to kind of, you know, anyway, embezzle money or whatever. But so 2/3 of the roundabouts in the world are in France. On this Tour de France, there are 500 roundabouts. That's almost one every 700 meters.
Kilometers, no?
Yeah, seven kilometers. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Which is, well, impressive in a way. I don't know. I mean, it's really French. You know,
it's one of the great sights of the tour, though, isn't it? The peloton splitting as they go round a roundabout.
A great one on the running, wasn't there, where everyone went to the right, and then there was a little train that thought about going left and realised that would be a mistake, and so they tried
to
cut in and go round, and they lost 40 places, and anyone who went round the left lost 80 places.
Yeah. And as we saw last year when there was an echelon created by Quickstep, I mean, with a good checking of the course, roundabouts can really become actually, play a part in the outcome of the race itself. So, there was already, you could say, nervousness. And I saw a tweet this morning from Jonathan Voters, you know, complaining about the course being tricky and dangerous. And as you said, well, many, many crashes. There were a couple others, less serious crashes that took place. Two were interesting. Nicholas Roach was the first to, it was a great day for Ireland, but it was not a great day for Nicholas Roach, who fell, quite hard on the tarmac. And it's ironic, because it was shortly after L'Île d'Oléron, and this morning he tweeted about L'Île d'Oléron, saying he spent his holidays there as a kid and watched his father won in La Bourboule, and it's one of these memories of seeing his father ride. Unfortunately, his more recent memory of L'Île d'Oléron will be a little bit sour and not as sweet as this one. Second crash that was interesting was Brian Coquard, because Brian Coquard crashed, said apparently that he was not going to do the sprint because he had crashed and was in pain in his back. And why was his back painful? Because, like many riders, he has the receiver of his radio system on the back, and apparently when riders crash on their backs, more often than not, I mean, these radio receivers kind of increase the seriousness of injuries. So another little you know, detail to for the some of the riders and team directors who are against radio system and ear equipment. But there you are.
Well, another crash before we move on to the stage finish itself. Guillaume Martin and Tadej Pogacar also hit the deck. Not too serious, we don't think. Obviously, we mentioned already Formolo, who Pogacar's help in the mountains is...
I think Formolo went down the same crash, didn't he?
That's right, yeah. But Formolo, very likely to be out, we think, out. But Sam Bennett, you know, it's been a while since he's been in the Tour de France. If you remember, he made his debut in 2015 and he got through a couple of weeks before he got sick and then went home. I think he got, you know...
We did an episode of Kilometre Zero, I think, didn't we, following him?
That was the following year, 2016.
That was the following year when he was
yeah.
in Lanterne Rouge.
Well, he crashed in the stage to Utah Beach on day one and really hurt his hand badly. And he was in a kind of claw-type brace all race, so he kind of... Like his fingers were, you know, he couldn't really move them. And he was
little
in a lot of pain.
Little interesting note, though, another person we followed 1 year, because he was Lanterne Rouge, and he was also in a lot of pain, was Michael Morkov.
That's right.
Because he was badly injured. And remember, we followed him for a few stages and heard a lot from him. And I think it was maybe the year before.
Yeah, possibly. But yeah, Bennett, you know, had a pretty unhappy first couple of experiences at the Tour. He finished in 2016. Was Lanterne Rouge, and I remember we interviewed him probably more often than he would have wanted, because we're always asking him the same question: how are you feeling? And he was going through real difficulty. I mean, the physical pain, but also the disappointment of not being able to perform. And he got really down on himself, I remember, in the final week, which seemed seemed unnecessary, because he was going through the pain barrier.
He's a very honest guy, and I remember also stage at the Giro when he was, you know, the his status had changed and he was a protected sprinter, and when he didn't win, he really felt like he'd let people down and would often be really, really upset. Mm. And he would share that with you when you went and stuck a recorder in his face.
And same time, yeah, I saw him one stage, with commanding fashion in Paris-Nice. And even when he wins, he's never like a triumphant guy. He gives the impression he's only done his job, and he's very self-demanding. And it showed today at the finish. During the interview for the International Signal, he cried throughout the interview.
Well, shall we hear a bit of that? Because it was very powerful and moving. And it was Seb Piquet asking the questions, and I thought Seb did the right. It was clear that at the start of the interview, Bennett was numb and hadn't absorbed what he'd done. And all it took actually was for Seb to say, "You won."
Mm.
And that set him off. And Seb was saying that Bennett set him off as well. So there were tears from Seb as well. But let's hear that interview, because it's difficult to listen to it and not be quite affected by it.
Sam Vedeta, take us through those emotions, the emotions of our Tour de France stage winner.
I don't think it's hit me, because I forgot to throw the bike at the line in the moment, and I thought he might have got me, and it hasn't hit me. I thought I'd be in the floods of tears, but I'm just kind of, I'm in shock.
You've won, I'm telling you, you've won. Been waiting for this such a long time.
Yeah. I just want to thank everyone that's been involved. Just want to thank the whole team and Patrick for giving me this opportunity, and just everybody he took to get to here. And I want to thank my wife and everyone around me. Sorry.
No, don't worry. I mean, why is it so emotional? Because it was so hard to get.
Yeah, just you dream of it and you never think it'll happen, and it does, and it did, and I don't know. It took me a while before it hit me, and oh man.
Do you think you could take us through that final straight, that battle with Caleb Ewan?
Yeah, I didn't. I thought maybe I was waiting to go, and I thought maybe I was waiting too late, and then I went, and I thought maybe I was in too big a gear, and I don't know.
It's even more special than you were expecting, maybe.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't mean to be a crybaby.
Congratulations. Thank you.
Well, it's been quite a journey for Sam Bennett here to get to this point of the Tour de France, almost a kind of expected and logical step in his progression to win a Tour stage, having won at both the other Grand Tours. But if you think, you know, he's He was in that Bora Argon team that then became Bora Hansgrohe and then had Peter Sagan parachuted in.
He was even in NetApp Enduro before that, wasn't he?
He's been with that team from the very early in its journey. But when Sagan joined the team, you know, that's going to bump anyone down the pecking order. And it meant that he wouldn't get a chance to ride the Tour de France for Bora Hansgrohe. He took his opportunities in the other two Grand Tours. In 2018, he won three stages in the Giro, and they're all very different. You know, the first one was kind of the monkey off his back, if you like. The second one in Imola, he really took it on himself and was very aggressive up this sharp climb, and then went very early in the sprint on the motor racing circuit. Possibly a tip there for the World Championships coming up in a few weeks' time. He also won in Rome on the final day. And then last year, he was kind of probably expecting to get a chance at the Tour de France, but was told right at the start of the season, no Giro, no Tour. And that left the Vuelta as, I guess, a bit of a consolation prize. I mean, imagine waiting, you know, two-thirds of the season before you get a chance to ride a Grand Tour. But he won in Alicante, won in Oviedo, and then there was this kind of bizarre saga about whether he'd be able to get out of Bora Hansgrohe to go to De Koenig Quickstep. And there was talk that Bora Hansgrohe had a kind of first refusal clause in the contract. But no, Bennett has moved across to De Koenig Quickstep. And as we will tell the story in Kilometre Zero tomorrow morning, sprinting for De Koenig Quickstep is a different level of beast to sprinting even in Bora Hansgrohe, because they expect victories. And our Kilometre Zero tomorrow will kind of tell the story of the pressure building on a rider as, you know, if the wins don't come immediately, the question is, when will the first one come? And we've seen that in this tour, really, because on day one in Nice, he was, you know, Alexander Kristoff is not a young man. You would have expected Bennett to be closer to Kristoff in Nice. At Sisteron, he was, you know, outdone by Caleb Ewan, and then another third place in Privas. So you get to the first rest day, no win on the board, and suddenly the pressure is turned up to 11. And with what was going on with De Koenig Quickstep this morning and the positive test and all of the rest of it regarding COVID, it must have been quite a roller coaster of a day for Bennett. And, well, he admitted as much in the press conference afterwards.
Really weird because, yeah, everything just kind of seemed to go too perfect at the end that I almost was in shock 50 metres to the line. I just couldn't believe it happened, and I thought maybe one person got by me, and after the line, it just didn't hit me. You know, you wait so many years for this to happen, and to get this opportunity, it took a while for it to really sink in. You know, it's just a relief when you have so many riders, there's great sprinters that passed through this team and delivered here. I needed this to come to the Tour de France to deliver for this team after Dakota Quickstep and Patrick gave me this opportunity, this amazing opportunity. I really wanted to deliver for them and also for my teammates who worked superb all day. I can't thank these guys enough, and the mechanics and the soigneurs and the DS, everybody here, the chef, the press officer, you know, just the whole team, the whole Wolfpack. I just want to thank them all for the support, and I can't thank them enough, and I'm just so happy and relieved that I could deliver this result.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
Thanks to the next generation Watt Bike Atom for sponsoring our Tour de France coverage this year. Yesterday we heard from Robert Ramsden Board, who had transformed his fitness with the help of the Watt Bike Atom. Let's hear a little more from him now.
You know, I'm not familiar with setting up a road bike because I've only ever been an off-road cyclist. So I actually had a professional bike fit done after about 3 or 4 months of using it because I was getting some knee pain and things. So I actually had it properly fitted up for me, which is unusual having a bike fit done on a static trainer at home. And it's been great. The numbers that I'm putting out now, because I track everything, I can see how I've progressed. And of course, that's quite motivating in itself because you've always got something to aim for then, because you've got your own best times, your own best endurance, your own longest ride, and you can see the progress. I mean, the analysis that the hub gives is very good for understanding where you're being efficient, where you're not being efficient. If you're not set up properly on the bike, you won't be getting the best out of what you're capable of. I think more importantly as well, if you want to stay injury-free and you want to be optimized for, you know, giving the best performance you can, particularly on something that has the ability to track the data the way that the Watt bike does, then it's a good idea to get yourself set up properly so that, you know, you're effectively making sure that every time you push the pedals around, you get the most out of it. You know, for me, that meant my endurance was able to go up in terms of time without, you know, without having any issues and without having any injuries as well. You know, the next goal for me, I might actually bite the bullet and buy a real bike. The only trouble with that is I don't think I'd actually enjoy it as much as I enjoy the indoor training. So I could find it a crushing disappointment to actually enter the real world. So it'd be interesting to try that. At the moment, I don't feel the need to do that because I'm enjoying what I'm doing with the Watt bike. It will probably be, for me, next thing, and maybe try some rowing as well, because that's probably the next thing coming to Zwift. There are only so many of these gadgets you can fit into your house before you might as well call it a gym. So, you know, there's a limit.
The Watt Bike Atom is available now from £90 per month. Go to wattbike.com. That's WATTBIKE.com.
I'm sure that's not the way Sam Bennett thinks, but look at the results. You know, it's even more of a vindication of all this, you know, long journey you just described. It beats Caleb Ewan into second place, the man who denied him his first win on the Tour de France earlier in this tour, and who's third, Peter Sagan, the man and whom he took the yellow jersey from, the man who kind of stopped him to taking part in the tour for the past 4 years. So really, you know, once again, symbolically, this win is grand for Bennett.
Just on Bennett and a little bit of his history. You know, he's kind of Sean Kelly in reverse, really, because Sean Kelly was the man from Carrick-on-Shore who made Belgium his second home and really fitted in Flanders. I lived there a number of years when he was a professional. And Sam Bennett was born in West Flanders because his dad, Michael, was a footballer, played for Waterford United, not Watford. Waterford United in the League of Ireland, and then he signed for Eintracht Wervik in Belgium.
I was going to say, why did he live in Belgium if he played for Waterford?
Well, because he signed for a Belgian club, Richard. I mean, yeah. Pretty logical.
Okay.
And Bennett was born there, and then the family moved back to Ireland when his dad got the manager's job at Waterford. And an interesting little thing about the cycling scene in Carrick-on-Shore, Sean Kelly's hometown, of course, and where Bennett grew up. There are two clubs called Carrick Wheelers. Sean Kelly rode for one of them. Sam Bennett rode for the other one. The Sean Kelly one was a kind of breakaway club set up by Tony Ryan, a sort of rebel offshoot, and they just called themselves the same thing.
Don't get any ideas if anyone's out there wants to set up a cycling podcast.
Very good idea there.
It's amazing, though, you know, that a place like Carrick-on-Shore, such a small. I've been through Carrick-on-Shore on the Ras actually 1 year, and we were riding along in the bunch. I've probably said this before, but we absorbed a guy riding along with mud guards and wearing kind of winter kit. It was May, so it was pretty cold, and it was Sean Kelly. Yeah, if it was anyone else, wow, they would have been, you know, hooked out of the race, but. He can do anything he likes, I think, in Carrick-on-Shore.
So he joined in with the Ross.
He was just riding along in the bunch for a bit.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. But it's a tiny place. And for, as you say, Francois, 40 years ago, Sean Kelly last won a bunch of it. But for two of Ireland's five stage winners, Martin Early won a
stage winner.
Six.
Dan Martin. Shay Elliott, Roach, Kelly.
Yeah, okay. But for two of them to come from Carrick-on-Shore is quite remarkable. And for them both to be sprinters as well. And there's a lot in Sam Bennett. There's a lot of Sean Kelly in Sam Bennett in a way, in that, you know, he's a humble, very down to earth guy. I don't see him getting carried away. And I guess that's one of the things that's interesting about his move to De Koning Quickstep. Because if you look at who he's following, it's Mark Cavendish, Marcel Kittel, Elia Viviani. Viviani also very down to earth, but that position of being the marquee sprinter at De Koning Quickstep, it's one of the most prestigious kind of roles in professional cycling. And Sam Bennett is quite an unlikely heir to those guys in a lot of ways. And it has put pressure on him. And as you say, Lionel, our episode of Kilometer Zero tomorrow is all about that pressure. I spoke to him yesterday. Yeah, he always sounds quite downbeat, so I didn't read too much into that. But I got to get a sense of the pressure building, you know, and that he had a chance today, he's got a chance tomorrow. But today we saw, you know, a good setup by Dukunin Quickstep and a fantastic lead out by Michael Morkov, which we saw in Nice as well. And, you know, Morkov kind of said there that you could read into his comments that Bennett hadn't really necessarily made the right choice. Today it all went perfectly and Morkov did a fantastic job.
And Bennett is back in the green jersey. And I know when we were talking about that earlier in the race, Francois, you said, and I agreed with you, that the stage win was the thing. The green jersey, you know, not a goal in itself. But now that he's in it, he said, well, I wasn't really thinking about it until I had the green jersey on my shoulders. And inevitably, once he's wearing it, now he's starting to think about it, but he'll be happy with whatever comes his way. It was interesting in the press conference, he talked about the three dream wins for him in his career would be Milan Sanremo, winning on the Champs-Élysées in green, and the World Championships. And who knows? I mean, I don't want to ramp the pressure up, but the Champs-Élysées and the World Championships might well be on, although there's a heck of a lot of climbing in that World Championships, isn't there? But
given the points awarded now for stage wins for the green jersey, as we saw today with Sagan, you know, third and losing 30 points on Bennett. I mean, if he wins tomorrow again, he has more chances to win in Poitiers than Sagan, and also in the Champs-Élysées. And if, you know, if he just manages to get over the mountain, even if Sagan takes a few intermediate sprints in the mountain stages, I think now Bennett is in as good a position to get the green jersey than Sagan in many ways.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for supporting Cycling Podcast. What's the code, Francois?
What
the code for Science in Sport?
SISCP
25. Yeah. SISCP 25 at scienceandsport.com. That's good. Excellent. I think you'll get it the next time. Yeah. Well done. But thank you to Science and Sport. Their support of us since 2016 is very gratefully received. And speaking of 2016, I see a tweet from Kieran Lennon, who works for the Irish Independent. He points out that Morkov and Bennett were both at the wrong end of the race in 2016, and it was after the crash on stage one in which they were both involved. And I remember for a while Morkov, I think, was riding for Tinkoff at the time, was in a lot of pain, and he was Lantern Rouge for a bit and just struggling to get through, and then Bennett ended up being Lantern Rouge as well. So it's just fascinating how cyclists' paths kind of twist and turn. And, you know, Morkov is, I remember we've touched on this in the Kilometer Zero tomorrow, but you know, it's worth mentioning again, he's an audio diarist for us as well, of course, but he's done such a brilliant job for so many different sprinters. He came to Dukunin Quickstep from Katusha, where he'd been a lead-out man for Christoph, and it seemed at the time that Christoph was a bit of a fading force, and, you know, they hadn't had all that much success. At Dukunin Quickstep, it's not just the sort of last two, but the whole team. You know, Kasper Asgreen was quite important today as well. They've got Bob Jungels, you know, they've got a lot of firepower, obviously Tim de Klerk as well, to just keep things under control for large parts of the stage. But Morkov, he's done a brilliant job for several different sprinters now, and he's a great lead-out man. He's a great sprinter. I mean, he's a great track rider as well, and his positioning is fantastic. That's one of the things that makes him, that sort of vision that he has to be in the right place is remarkable, really. And I guess, you know, we don't often give lead-out men their due, do we? I remember that in Mark Cavendish's heyday, Mark Renshaw got a lot of praise as being a brilliant lead-out man, and Morkov's in the same category, I think.
Yeah, and Bennett did make that point after the stage, and not just the lead-out train, the lead-out car, I mean, I guess. I mean, what?
Lead-out car?
Lead-out carriage. One lead-out carriage and then then Bennett.
Okay, fair enough.
But also to Patrick Lefebvre, who's given him the opportunity to be the number
one
sprinter.
Who you saw last night, Lionel, striding across the...
Yeah, and then when the whole news about coronavirus and Dukunin Quickstep broke this morning, I was thinking maybe Lefebvre had been in a particularly busy restaurant. Mm. But I mean, I think
did
it's got
see,
a longer
did,
incubation
did you see him
period
this morning.
But he might not have been in the bubble.
I don't think he's in the bubble, you're right.
No, because he's just arrived, I think. Right, I don't think he's been here the whole time. Anyway, chaps, speaking of busy restaurants, wine of the day jingle in here, please.
Do you want me to sing a song? I'll tell you
Did
why.
We want you to sing a song, yes.
I'll tell you why. No, because usually the Tour de France is in July, right? And so on the 14th of July, you kind of force me to sing La Marseillaise. But we're in September, and so there's no national anthem to be sung. And there's actually, the race was finishing today for the first time in L'Île Dorée, which means that actually the tour has now stopped in almost all the largest islands in metropolitan France, the largest being Corsica, of course. They went to Oléron for the second time this year. This year went to Noirmoutier in the past. There's only one island that that's missing on the of the largest ones that's missing on the tour map, and it's Belle-Île-en-Mer. But Belle-Île-en-Mer, you need to take the boat to get there. So there's, I think the tour will never go to Belle-Île. So they've almost done the whole thing. And there's a very nice little song about L'Île de Ré that I like very much. So I...
Please. So if you insist, you know,
we insist. Okay, and it's a nice one because it's a song that's based in September as well. So it goes. Oh, Madame is listening.
An audience is fine for
that's fine. Yeah. Dans l'île de Ré, ma belle adorée, je t'emmènerai bientôt au mois le plus tendre, le mois de septembre, où l'on peut s'étendre bien seul. Mes parents y vivent, tout près de la rive bordée de salive nacrée. Là, la fleur marine, parlée de narines, emplit la poitrine d'un parfum sucré.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Do you want Lionel Knight to join in the second chorus?
Le vin du jour, à votre santé.
Well, now we know, while we were on our bike ride and watching the Tour de France, we know what Francois has been up to for the last 12 or 13 hours.
Yeah, well, we are having our wine of the day. It's obviously the white wine is bringing that out of you, Francois. We're actually skipping back a couple of stages.
That's
in our
right, yeah. It's not from L'Île de Ré, this one. It's un jour ensemble. The song is actually by a French crooner, a kind of crooner called Claude Nougaro, who's famous to people living in Toulouse. This one you've got here is closer to Claude Nougaro's place than it is to L'Île de Ré. It's un Jurançon. And Jurançon is a famous, this one is dry Jurançon. It's a famous kind of aperitif white wine from the region of Pau. Jurançon is just outside of Pau, actually. And remember last year, the La Course took place on the circuit, and it went through Jurançon. So it's actually, really the Pau local wine. I'm not a great, sweet white wine fan, but Jurançon is something else. It's like really like an aperitif. It's tasty. It's got body and it's got personality. A little bit like sherry. I mean, it's this sort of wine you don't usually have dinner with Jurançon, throughout the meal. But as an aperitif, this one is very good. It's not too heavy on alcohol. 12.5, I think. It's got real taste and an interesting bitterness to it. It's fresh and refreshing. Well,
I think
good stuff.
It's absolutely delicious.
It's
a lovely golden color.
And
it is slightly dry and sweet, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really delicious. And it's part of the collection, the Cycling Podcast collection put together by Divine Cellars. We've been seeing that a few of you have bought cases. Greg from Divine will deliver anywhere in the UK. DivineCellars.com. There are various cases available if you'd like to follow us on our wines Tour de France. We'll be doing another one tomorrow, hopefully. But yeah, very nice, that one. I mean, I do love a nice white wine. Anyway, back to the cycling. In last night's press conference, we were asked a question about nicknames, and we had quite a big response to that today from people. So some of them were suggestions, some of them were reminders of nicknames that already exist. Guillaume Martin, Socrates, was a suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
He's a philosopher. Mark Hershey, of course, we christened him, or I think Francois christened him, Baby Spartacus. Somebody reminded me of my finest moment when I called Balcom Olama Book Molima because he reads a lot of books.
I read the books. So there we are.
Yeah.
There we are.
See what I did there? Nans Peters Le Pingouin, according to The Inner Ring.
Mm. Maybe it's true, yeah.
The best blog on cycling that you'll find on Tinternet, Inner Ring. Thanks for that. Connor Swift, somebody, Gary Bandy, suggested that he be called the bodyguard or Donny Dorman.
The Donny Dorman.
A Doncaster reference for Francois there.
Mm-hmm.
with your Doncaster history, Francois. Ilona Zakharin is the stork of Tatarstan, according to Joachim Eriksson. I didn't know that, but that's a good one.
A stork's good at descending?
Well, he does. He's quite stork-like, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. Angular.
Tim de Klerk, of course, is a tractor. Steen VH reminded us of that. Somebody suggested the tour so far, Alex Dickinson, this was, has been a portrait of the Aertist as a young man. Wow, Van Aert.
The Aertist.
Van Aert. We call him Art, don't we? So I don't know why I said Aert.
Yeah, so it's the artist.
A portrait of the artist as a young man. Sergio Higuita is the Gila monster. And Tom Demoulin is, of course, the Butterfly of Maastricht.
One of the worst nicknames not in really the entire history of nicknames.
Oh, there's the Butterfly of Maastricht. Yeah. It doesn't really trip off the tongue,
no,
does it?
He's not butterfly-like either, is he?
No. No.
I mean, a butterfly wouldn't stop mid-stage to have a poo. Anyway, back to the Tour de France. I can say that because Daniel's not here with his phobia.
And this comes from a flying pudding, so who knows what you do when you're
flying blamange. Anyway. It's the best nickname of the Tour so far. People seem to have enjoyed that one quite a lot. Anyway, yes, back to the stage. I mean, we watched it speed through La Rochelle, didn't we, Lionel? Big crowds out for
huge
it.
Huge crowd, really.
Huge crowds,
the biggest crowds I've seen in the race so far.
Huge crowds, but very quiet crowds.
Well, as you mentioned at the time, everyone kind of muffled because of the masks, and it did feel quite muted. It was strange. It was, I don't know. I'm finding the proximity with people challenging, I must admit. It's been the most peculiar couple of weeks, or, well, not couple of weeks yet, is it, but 10 days or so. But to see everyone kind of watching the tour like normal, but with the masks on, I suppose.
And La Rochelle, more than anywhere else, actually, has felt very normal to me in terms of people being out. Lots of young people here, aren't there? Is it a student, a big student town?
Yeah, it's just kind of a posh, touristy student town. So, yeah, you've got lots of young people, absolutely. I guess we'll have to get used to it. It's not in the Tour de France. For the month to come, I'm afraid, you know, normal life will be wearing a mask, even outside now. In most of France, now it's compulsory to wear a mask everywhere. So, the surprise today was the huge crowds, like almost normal Tour de France crowds, when in the first week, as we pointed out, you know, there were not that many people on the roadside. Today, I think from start to finish, I mean, really huge crowds. And okay, the average age, as we pointed out already, was quite high, but not only. I mean, it was not really, really interesting to see. We also know that September is also the period when you know, pensioners, or on the other end, you know, young professionals or people, you know, just out of university starting on their first job, some take their holidays on September. So you have a different crowd of holiday makers. So, and lots of them, you know, spend their holidays here in La Rochelle or L'Île de Ré or L'Île d'Oléron, very fashionable with Parisians. Lots of Parisians actually went to Île de Ré during the lockdown, and there was criticism from the locals just to see these Parisians coming to spread the COVID among them. And there was, you know, there were rumors that, you know, of course, toilet paper would go missing on Île de Ré because of this invasion. So it's, you know, it's very fashionable with tourists. But I was not expecting that many people to be watching the tour today. And I don't know, maybe the first week has something to do with it. Maybe actually the spectacle, the show is going on, and it seems to appeal to people. So with a mask or without a mask.
I mean, I think we woke up this morning quite apprehensive about what the news would be with regards to the COVID test. We, you know, I think when you look at other sports events and sports that have tried to resume in far less normal circumstances without crowds and so on, and they've had quite a lot of cases among athletes, I expected riders to be positive.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it was difficult to say, but I mean, I think it's one of two things, isn't it? Either the race bubble has been very effective, which clearly it has been, or the testing is not effective, which, you know, we have no basis to suspect that that would be the case. I mean, we do know that the kind of the retest of anyone positive has given the kind of reassurance that, you know, there aren't false positives.
Yeah.
Because false positives would be, that would damage the credibility of the event, wouldn't it? If somebody tested positive, had to leave the race. I'm talking about a rider, tested positive, left the race, and then in 2 days is on social media saying, well, I've tested negative three times since I left the Tour de France.
And if he'd taken out his whole team in the process.
In a way, it's part of the deal. I mean, they were forced to somehow announce what the rules would be, and teams were warned that whatever happens, even in case of a false positive, I mean, that's the only scientific. I mean, it can happen to any one of you or us. We could be wrongly quarantined, and we wouldn't complain or go to court as opposed to. The rules that put onto the riders and the teams from the start were clear. So if a second positive test occurs in a team, well, the team will be out, and they know that. I mean, that's the plan. I mean, of course, it could be terrible and contested and maybe denied by facts a little bit later on. But sometimes the rules are stupid, but they're the rules.
And there's another D-Day ahead of us next week, and obviously with four staff members testing positive, there's no way that they won't have had close contact with the riders and obviously with other people on the team. So there's a sort of a sense of a time bomb in a way, perhaps. I don't know, but if things carry on as they are and COVID doesn't have a sort of devastating impact on the field and the people taking part, then you'd have to say that would be a great success. And I think, if that is the case, the riders, we sort of touched on this last night in the episode about, we were asked about, the lengths that the riders have gone to try and keep themselves safe and healthy. I think it's a great sort of endorsement of the lengths that cyclists will go to. And I'm not sort of drawing comparison with other sports, but we've been very aware in other sports of athletes, sports people sometimes, breaking the lockdown rules or the bubble rules that they're supposed to follow.
I also think it's. I'm not saying I don't know enough about other sports to know whether this is true or not, but we do know that cycling, the Tour de France, the Grand Tours, they're almost a kind of a. Well, they're a test of people's immune systems in a certain way, aren't they? We always comment on how the illnesses catch up with riders in the third week as they get more and more tired. The peloton is just one big mass of people all breathing and let's not put too fine a point on it, snotting and spitting on each other. I mean, that's what it's like in the peloton, as unpalatable as that sounds. But on the flip side, professional cycling is probably a step ahead in terms of cleanliness protocols and the hand sanitizer and not shaking hands. I mean, we've joked about this in the past about, and it's not just Team Sky. They may well have been towards the cutting edge of teams aware of this kind of thing. But I remember even back in sort of 2010, 11, when they had the list of rules on the team bus about using the hand sanitizer as soon as they get on the bus. This kind of stuff has been ingrained in the teams for, up to 10 years. And so the measures are in place to try to restrict. And certainly we saw the interview with Dave Brailsford in The Guardian talking about the team. People talk about, slightly mock the restaurant car that they have and the kitchen. But having the riders eating in a controlled environment rather than going in and out of hotel dining rooms as well, it's just trying to control as many environments as possible.
As you said, they've always been in the bubble. The difference with football, as we saw with that there are about a dozen positive COVID test at Paris Saint-Germain now, but what is the difference? Paris Saint-Germain players, they go to training and then they go back home and they go out to the restaurant and they have a life. And it turned out that apparently the COVID cases came from a party in Ibiza that they had after the Champions League. Riders don't go out partying after the stage, or they don't go to
not
the restaurant,
days.
Or they no, not these days. And in a way, they've
except the welter.
Yeah, in a way they've been more protected than ever. I'm not very competent at cycling, and I'm probably even less competent at medicine and coronavirus crisis. But to think that you have the impression some guys were hoping that there would be lots of catastrophe, lots of COVID cases, all the guys contaminated and infected. But to believe this means that you believe that social distancing and masks are useless. And but the riders are respecting social distancing. They're wearing masks, and it seems to work. So that's we should be happy.
That good work. If they're all good clear, news, you know? Then they can snot on each other as much as they like.
Yeah,
they're not going to pass on COVID. Yeah. I mean that's yeah.
But it's a huge boost for the race to get through that one. And you know,
and
I know
we're not there yet.
No,
you know what I mean?
But and these are in a way they're arbitrary and artificial kind of deadlines, aren't they? But the fact that somebody would have to now be symptomatic in order to require a test and then perhaps trigger a team leaving the race. And so this is so difficult, isn't it? But really, what do we want? We do want things to kind of go on. We do
what
want
do we
the
want?
Tour to reach
Tour de France.
Yeah, we want everybody involved in the Tour de France caravan, including some of our colleagues who are not on the tour, to be safe and healthy, you know?
Let's wrap things up for tonight. We're in Poitiers tomorrow night. I'm sure Lionel will tell us lots about Poitiers and Sean Kelly. But before we go, let's say a few thank yous to friends of the podcast. Thank you to everybody who signed up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. You can get lots of exclusive stuff there, episodes, and there's lots more to come, actually, this year. But thanks from me to Ian Simpson, Matthew Andrews, Helen Schmedeman, Nick Sweeney, David Cole, and Robert Williams.
And a big thank you from me to Alan McLean, Mr. H. Tomlinson, I love that, the formality of that, excellent. Nick Long, Jerry Wells, CJH Ludwig, another very formal lady or gentleman, and Mark Eves, thank you.
And un grand merci to Tony O'Malley, Michael Stephen Rickson, Peter Newland, Rutger Brookhuysen, Ken Jamieson, and Mike Barnett.